Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What will it take for Mexico to wrest control of cities like Juarez away from bloodthirsty drug cartels and restore a measure of prosperity and stability for innocent people trying to live, work, and raise families? As turf wars rage between drug trafficking organizations in border cities and beyond, cross-border commerce has fallen away, legitimate businesses are forced to pay extortion fees, and regular people are left cut off from their communities by fears of violence and distrust of law enforcement. My guest today has studied the problem where it is happening and offers some surprising ideas about what might make things better in a recent paper for the Brookings Institution, where she is a fellow of the Latin American Initiative and also the 21st Century Defense Initiative. Vonda Felbaugh-Brown is also author of the 2009 book Shooting Up, Counterinsurgency and the War on Drugs. She's in town to speak this evening to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. Vonda, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we've heard for a long time from the Mexican government that really drug violence is only affecting people who somehow get themselves wrapped up in the business, either in the distribution side or as a user. But talk about the ways in which that is no longer the case.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't think it was ever completely the case. Mm-hmm. To the extent that you have anywhere very intense violence, and the violence in Mexico is extraordinary, even by criminal market standards, it's way more violent than what normal drug markets look like. The violence is affecting a community. You know, often the government of Mexico will say, well, it's only narcos killing other narcos. It's only narcos killing each other. And sort of implied that then the violence should not be particularly disturbing. I think that's an invalid argument for many reasons. If narcos were killing each other on the moon, then perhaps it would not mm-hmm. be affecting the community. But as long as they're killing each other on the street of a society, on the street of a community, it's affecting the life of the community. And moreover, the responsibility of a government is to prevent any sort of violence, even criminal violence among criminals. Nonetheless, I think that the violence has become just so intense and the communities have been hurting so much that even Mexico City, even Los Pinos, the seat of the presidency, is realizing that the violence is problematic. And we have seen different messaging. And more importantly, we have seen the rise of groups such as by Javier Sestilia trying to agitate against the violence, trying to bring the hurt that the community is feeling to the attention of both society at large and the government.
There's been an active drug industry in Mexico, illicit drug industry, for some time. But for decades, there wasn't much of a market for their products domestically. And that has really changed. What are the reasons for the increased consumption of illicit drugs in Mexico?
I think there are several. In many countries that become the sources or a transshipment areas for drugs, they eventually develop addiction patterns as well. Part of it is because drug traffickers like to pay their local dealers or their local smugglers in kind. It relieves them of the need to change money and give them money, and it allows them to also not worry about law enforcement issues, about money exchange issues, etc. So they like to they like to pay in kind, and then local smugglers develop an interest in setting up a way to change the drugs into money, and hence develop local markets. So we see that often in very many different parts of the world. At the same time, we also have seen a shift of consumption worldwide. You know, it used to be that Western Europe and the United States were sort of the principal consuming markets. And they still are very strong markets. But we have seen with the emergence of middle class, modernization, economic growth, other countries coming on market. Brazil and Argentina today probably have per capita consumption on par with the United States. We don't know exactly because many of these countries don't take good don't measure very actively mm-hmm. and very effectively consumption patterns. Historically, have not done so. So we are not completely certain, but lots of the evidence that's coming out is pointing to new drug markets that are extremely robust and as intense as the old ones. And worldwide, that's true also about Russia, one of the biggest drug markets in the world. China, back full strength again. So Mexico is falling into both categories. Both the smugglers have an interest in developing local markets, and the country is experiencing prosperity, is growing, is modernizing, middle class is growing, all of which lead to greater use.
I want to talk about Tijuana here, which some people describe as a sort of miracle example of getting the problem under control. And you have described in a much more nuanced fashion that there have been successes. There are also things that may not be easily duplicated mm-hmm. in other places. One of the things that changed was they got a new police chief there that had come from the Mexican army.
Mm-hmm. And the police chief you're referring to is Julian Lizaloa, a very famous personality in Mexico today. And he came to Tijuana after violence in Tijuana was escalating and almost doubling per year. And he came from the military, and at the same time, the military was operating in Tijuana. And he also coincided with a general from the military who was directing the military operations there. And the two of them were able to very effectively work together to strengthen cooperation between police forces, specifically the municipal police forces that Lizaloa was in charge of, and the military operation. Back up a little bit before explaining more of the Tijuana story for your listeners, the broader law enforcement pattern in Mexico, which is that President Calderon, when he assumed the presidency, essentially decided that the police forces were incapable of handling the drug violence and the drug trafficking organizations. And so to areas of especially intense violence, he sent out the military to places like Ciudad Juarez, Tijuana, Michoacan. And so there the military was coinciding in performing law enforcement operations with the police. And by and large, this joint operations have not been joined and, in fact, have been extremely problematic for mm-hmm. many reasons, one of which is that the military is not really tasked and suited necessarily for doing law enforcement operations. They cannot conduct investigation. They're prohibited by Mexican law from conducting investigation. But also because the police forces are very hollowed out, very corrupt, extraordinarily fractured, and also divided along multiple layers of command.
Mm-hmm.
So institutional cooperation, cross-agency cooperation has been a nightmare in Mexico. So Lizaloa and Durante, the general, the military general in Tijuana, were able to really get beyond the stovepiping and were able to jointly operate. Lizaloa was also very aggressive and determined in purging out corruption from the municipal forces. And he was widely credited with discouraging the corruption and the cooperation between organized crime and municipal police forces in Tijuana. And after his departure from Tijuana, or the before he departed to Ciudad Juarez, we saw violence dropping in Tijuana, and it's been dropping and it's been staying low. Mm-hmm. So people said, it was the Lizaloa factor, it was his cooperation with Duarte that brought the violence down. And I think it's an element of it. But unfortunately, I don't think we can attribute the whole strategy to the two men who received honors in Mexico and were sort of became very prominent personalities, kind of TV-like personalities in mm-hmm. Mexico. And the reason that we cannot attribute the whole success to them is that other things were happening in the drug market. Mainly one cartel, the Sinaloa cartel, was able to defeat its old rivals in Tijuana. They were able to defeat some of the factions in Tijuana that opposed them, including Los Zetas. They were able to consolidate control over the central part of the city. And much of the drop in violence was simply that they won.
So if one group is in charge of everything, there's a sort of what you call narco peace, which is that there's not violence among different cartel members because they're working together.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, some of the institutional changes that we would like to see deepen in Mexico, including purging the municipal police forces of corruption, are actually questionable in the Tijuana case. You know, Lazaloa, despite his sort of super cop type imagery, was accused of human rights violations, some very, very severe human rights violations, of both tolerating them and also perhaps even being more complicit in them than simply tolerating them. And so lots of the people who were purged out from the municipal police force were ultimately not effectively prosecuted. They were released from jail because the evidence didn't hold. And many of them were alleging that they were simply victims, that they were not corrupt. Now, my suspicion is that many probably were corrupt, but part of the difficulty for Mexico, but a critical element is that evidence needs to stick. People need to be able to be prosecuted through the judicial system and serve punishments. And whether it's because the procedural violations take place during the arrests and the prosecutorial aspect of it, or later on in the courts, if those elements don't come in together, anti-corruption drives won't be effective. Now, Lazaloa is in Ciudad Juarez after he was removed from the position of police chief in Tijuana, and he was sent to Juarez with this sort of hero image of rescuing Ciudad Juarez.
6 months ago he arrived, right?
Yeah, he came to Juarez in March.
Okay, seven.
Right. Mm-hmm. And violence is dropping in Juarez, so many people are saying, ah, it's the Lazaloa factor again. So mm-hmm. It's a super cop image. Perhaps, and I wish that was the case. I'm not certain. I'm not certain that anyone really knows why the violence in Juarez is dropping, but it's been down.
So let's talk about when you had Mexican soldiers in Juarez. First of all, the residents of the city absolutely hated it, and again, you get to the issue where they're not necessarily working well with municipal authorities. The other problem is that they weren't really assigned effectively, so there were questions about what they were supposed to be doing there.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's problem beyond Ciudad Juarez. I mean, the problem with the Mexican strategy overall was precisely this lack of clarification and specification of what the mandate of the military actually is. So at the strategic level, the government had the compelling rationale. The argument was the police forces are so corrupt, so hollowed out, so lacked effectiveness, that we will place in the military in charge of law enforcement functions while we are reforming the police, and then the police will take over back. So what we want the military to do is to reduce the threat from a national security threat that we believe the threat is right now to a public safety threat. Then mm-hmm. the police will be back in charge. The problem was that even the best strategy can die in implementation unless one is very careful and specific in designing the implementation element of it. Mm-hmm. And this is what often did not take place in Mexico. So the military would be sent out there, but the military would sort of arrive and have to figure out what is it that they were exactly supposed to do. What does it mean that one is supposed to reduce the threat from national security one to public safety one? Mm-hmm. Were the military to be patrolling streets? Were they to be arresting people? They couldn't do investigation. They can simply arrest people who were designated by someone else as a target. Or they can arrest people during in flagrante, so with crime is being committed right in front of their mm-hmm. eyes. But then they cannot follow up. So more often than not, the military ended up doing two things. Patrolling streets. Anyone who sort of knows anything about counterinsurgency or law enforcement will tell you that there is only so much you can do from standing on the street. So mm-hmm. more often than not, they just snarled up the traffic. They would sort of check some cars, and occasionally the narcos would send some car for entertainment's sake to the military. They mm-hmm. would arrest some people with weapons and perhaps drugs. But by and large, the narcos very quickly learned where is it that the military was standing on the street,
and
they would operate
elsewhere. My guest this hour is Vanda Feldbaum-Brown. She's a fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of a new paper called Calderón's Cauldron, Lessons from Mexico's Battle Against Organized Crime and Drug Traffic in Tijuana, Juarez, and Michoacán. You can read the entire thing at brookings.edu. Her book is called Shooting Up, Counterinsurgency and the War on Drugs, and she's in town to speak this evening to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. You can find more information about that at dallasinstitute.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Vonda Felbaugh-Brown. She's a fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the 2009 book Shooting Up, Counterinsurgency and the War on Drugs. She's in town to speak this evening about the Mexican drug wars to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So to this issue of police corruption, you know, we've heard for a long time the sort of threats that are posed to police officers, you know, silver or lead. You either get a reward or you get a bullet to the head. There's that issue of fear. I wonder how much things like training and vetting new candidates to be police officers would make a difference, or does Mexico not have the financial resources to make these changes?
Mm-hmm. Well, training and vetting is important and is critical. Several pieces need to click into place during police reform. For any country, undertaking law enforcement reform, police reform is often one of the most challenging things, because you're talking about people with guns sanctioned to commit violence who are all the time interacting with criminals. Mm-hmm. So having good police and discipline is often even more difficult than having good discipline in the military. Mm-hmm. And countries are often far more capable of undertaking military reform than undertaking police reform. Yet at the same time, it is an indispensable, inescapable role of a state is to provide public safety domestically. And so police forces play a crucial role. Mexico is very much challenged, historically has been challenged, and for a variety of reasons, police forces have become very corrupt, very hollowed out. And Mexico has gone through several rounds of police reform since the 80s, all of which essentially didn't work out, partially because they simply tended to rename the institution, and partially because they tended to react to problems by putting military officers, former military officers, into ranking positions in the military. But at the same time, you have huge pressure from the drug trafficking organizations to corrupt people. So I think President Calderon needs to be given very much credit for understanding that it was essential to conduct deep police reform, and also for reaching out to the United States to help with police reform. And so under first Merida initiative, and what later under the Obama administration was renamed as Beyond Merida, but as the assistance to Mexico, U.S. has been assisting with police reform.
Obviously, the United States is not without corrupt law enforcement officers, mm-hmm. but we tend to have faith that that's a rare occurrence. Is that the explanation for why violence in Tijuana hasn't spilled over to Southern California, and violence in Juarez, for the most part, has not really affected crime rates in El Paso?
I think it's part of the explanation. I think that there's sort of broader explanation, in my view, and that is that the United States has very effective police forces. Mm-hmm. The U.S. police forces, especially local police forces, used to be very corrupt going into the 50s. And it was Bobby Kennedy who really, through the use of FBI and prosecutors and the Justice Department, was able to launch very robust police reform that continued into past Bobby Kennedy into the 70s, and we ended up with very effective police departments. That said, we have problems all the time. Some police department is put into receivership. But it is something very important for even Mexico to know and to learn, that when police departments are problematic, when they are too violent or unable in responding to violence, that there are institutional mechanisms that the state, in this case the Justice Department, takes control of the police department and directs them. And so there have been incidences in New Orleans recently. The police department has been put in receivership. So I think that the fact that our police forces are far less corrupt are a critical element of why we see less violence. But the other is they're simply not corrupt, but they're also very effective in being able to identify criminals, apprehend criminals, and send them through the prosecution system into jails or have them face penalties. Mm-hmm. And so law enforcement has a very great deterrent effect. Criminals understand that there are certain lines that they cannot cross. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I often semi-joke, but also semi-mean it seriously, is that law enforcement will never undo crime. What the function of law enforcement is to persuade criminals to be good criminals, to understand that perhaps they will want to engage in drug trafficking and they'll be punished, but they should not do so violently, that there are limits to how they can behave, and especially violent crime is what needs to be the priority focus of law enforcement. And in Mexico, law enforcement does not have this credibility that we have in the U.S.
Why is there such a dearth of really solid intelligence gathering among Mexican law enforcement? I mean, it's a complicated process, but it's not rocket science. It would seem that officers who have lived and worked in an area would be able to gather intelligence about criminal activity.
Mm. And, you know, it's, again, a combination of factors. Corruption plays a very important mm-hmm. role, and the fear that police officers are exposed to plays a role. For a long time, during the rule of the PRI, the party that ruled Mexico for 71 years, the law enforcement institution took, at the highest level, took the same corporatist approach that the party took to dealing with unions, teachers, the other aspects of society. They would sort of strike bargains and direct how these institutions could behave. And so law enforcement had essentially a deal with the drug trafficking groups that we will turn a blind eye to your taking drugs to the United States as long as you behave within certain parameters. And the deal started breaking down in the 80s, but the consequence of the deal was that law enforcement for a long time stopped doing what it was supposed to be doing. They were not gathering intelligence often, or often the intelligence was gathered only by some organizations, but not disseminated. Mm-hmm. You get into sort of a whole host of other problems. Often local police forces essentially served as private militias of the mayor or the rich local personality, rather than interacting with the community, going out among the community. And, you know, going back to your question about why is it not happening in the U.S., one thing that I am very worried is that if we turn our local police forces into enforcing anti-immigration issues, looking for people without documents, that we will really hurt very fundamentally one of the reasons why we have such effective police forces. That is, there is a great deal of trust and information coming from the community to our police forces. And so we get preoccupied with immigration, illegal immigration, and really don't understand that if we turn police forces into being enforcers of that, local police forces, we can very much intensify crime issues in the U.S.
Because people then are afraid to call the police when they know of something.
Absolutely, and this is especially relevant in the case of Mexico, where to the extent that the drug trafficking groups will try to start operating more violently on the U.S. side, or start expanding their extortion operations in the U.S., or perhaps even kidnapping, the community that will be first exposed and most aware will be the Latino community, people who have relatives in the Mexico, who perhaps come from Mexico. And so if we give a signal to this community that they need to be totally fear, they need to be totally in fear of law enforcement, they will then not come forward. They will not inform law enforcement that they are being extorted or that they are being targeted for kidnapping, that these groups are starting to operate. Now, if anything, the key innovation of law enforcement over the past two or three decades was community policing, the idea that police need to interact with the population, have close, thick relations, develop, know your police, mm-hmm. know your community. And we don't want to undermine that.
Vonda, talk about what has happened to communities where people are afraid to let their children play, even in their own front yards. They are afraid to leave the house unless they absolutely have to get to work. People aren't talking to one another in the ways that they did before, and that has a huge and devastating impact on the overall ability to maintain peace and stability.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Chris. And, you know, this goes back to your opening question. Is the violence a problem? Are narcos simply killing each other? Does it matter? And my response that as long as the bullets are flying on the streets, it matters. Mm-hmm. Because to the extent that a community has a role, has a voice in responding to violence, it is because it can exchange information, it can mobilize, people can draw strength from each other. Part of the reason why the north of Mexico, places like Ciudad Juarez, like Tijuana, and places in between are so badly affected by the violence is that often the community there was weak to start with. It was often very transient communities, people coming to work, in the Maquilas or even people preparing to leave for the United States.
So lots already of, cut off from their own communities.
Already cut off from their own communities, often very transient community, not knowing each other, not interacting deeply. Mm-hmm. And many of the social problems of Tijuana, Ciudad Juarez is lack of places to bond people, lack of schools, lack of healthcare facilities that also have other impact on human capital, not simply the bonding, lack of stadiums, lack of opportunities to interact, to engage, to get together, to talk with neighbors. Mm-hmm. And because many of these areas just doubled, tripled in geographic size as people were moving in to work in the Maquilas or even to cross into the United States. And if violence further fractures that, if violence sends people behind doors, the ability of a community to adapt, to react, to counter, to thrive, just becomes terribly, terribly undermined.
And I guess if you don't know the people next door, you're less inclined to want to do something about it if they're in trouble.
Yes, and of course then the reverse also takes place, that if mm-hmm. you face a threat, why should the neighbors help you? Yeah. Now, if your restaurant is being extorted and you have not engaged with your neighbors, why should they try to set up some sort of mechanism to help you? Absolutely. So it's very much important that people can relate to the state, that they can trust the state, that the state will be responsive to their needs and help them. But it's equally important that people have the ability to interact, to exchange ideas. So one of the very worrisome things in Mexico, and one that the government needs to pay far more attention to than it has, it's a rather systematic effort by the drug trafficking groups to target community organizers, target NGO workers, journalists especially. We have seen recently attacks on bloggers, on sort of citizens active on the web who are not even professional journalists, killing them, torturing them in an extraordinarily brutal manner. And so if these community organizers go, then the chance that the community will come together and overcome the fractures is even smaller. And so providing them with protection needs to be a very important aspect of the strategy.
Vonda Felbaugh-Brown of the Brookings Institution is my guest. You can read her paper online at Brookings.edu. It's called Calderón's Cauldron, Lessons from Mexico's Battle Against Organized Crime and Drug Traffic in Tijuana, Juarez, and Michoacán. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372. We have Bob on the line in Fort Worth. Hello, Bob.
Hi, Chris. I wondered if your guest might comment, take a stab at the percentage of the violence resulting directly from marijuana as opposed to all other types of drugs. The thought I have is that much ado or many of killings are related to the restricting marijuana trade as opposed to other drugs, and I wondered if your guest might be able to comment on that.
What do you know about that, Vonda?
The issue of marijuana and what role it plays in the violence is one that comes up frequently. I think that no one can really with any certainty say this amount of violence can be attributed to smuggling of marijuana and this amount of violence can be attributed to other drugs or other aspects of criminality. More and more, the violence is actually very complex, and it's stemming not simply from illegal cross-border trade, but from issues such as local extortion of businesses, of legal businesses, efforts by the drug trafficking group to franchise other enterprises, such as, for example, the informal economy, selling of tortillas on the Zocalo, or from efforts of them controlling prostitution markets in Mexico, none of which involve crossing the border. Now, the reason marijuana comes up a lot is because some prominent voices have argued that if marijuana were legal, that would reduce the violence. People say that marijuana brings a lot of profit, and again, big debate. Some people would say 60%, others would say far less than that of the profits of the drug trafficking groups come from marijuana. And so the argument that's presented often is that if marijuana were legal, then either the violence would fall off because so much of the violence is about marijuana, or the profits would go rapidly down, and that would weaken, perhaps bankrupt the drug trafficking groups. I am very uncomfortable with both sets of arguments, partially because it makes the assumption. Well, first of all, even if one were actually to believe the numbers, and frankly, we don't know what the numbers are, the fact that 60% of the money were eliminated would not necessarily imply that the groups would simply say, okay, it was a nice run, it was great when the market was illegal, now we go home and behave well. Mm-hmm. I think more and more we would see what we are already seeing, efforts to extort other legal businesses, efforts to get involved in siphoning of oil from Pemex, mm-hmm. Simply develop other extortion mechanisms, other protection rackets, many of which could be far more violent and not necessarily bring very much smaller profits. So I often make the argument that if a country wants to legalize some commodity or make some commodity illegal, irrespective of the decision that might be driven by other considerations of such as drug use, it needs to have an effective law enforcement.
Yeah, I guess there's no reason to assume that even if it were legal, that the suppliers would want to make a smaller profit than whatever they'd been making before when they had no regulation whatsoever.
Right. So you can get into sort of whole lots of complication and questions. Well, who legalized? Do we legalize that? The United States, does Mexico legalize? Do both legalize? Say right now that the United States legalizes, or even Mexico, let's say both countries. In both cases, you would probably want some taxation, both because you want to bring revenue for the state and also because you want to discourage use in the same way that we have taxes on cigarettes. Mm-hmm. Well, but if you have taxation, then you can imagine another black market emerging underneath the legal market to avoid taxation, the same reason why there is a huge illegal trade with cigarettes, even in places where cigarettes are permitted. The other question is, well, would the narcos simply say, okay, we are no longer in marijuana, or would they continue investing in legal marijuana enterprises? Is it problematic that you have extremely violent actors joining the legal economy? Some people would say, well, no, you know, it's like the old U.S. Businessmen in Wild West, many of whom had short reach to the revolver, you know, they eventually became productive members of society, so maybe that's fine. I would posit that the levels of violence is very different in Mexico and that we should not allow the extraordinarily brutal violent drug traffickers to become simply legalized into Mexican society and economy.
Vonda Felbaugh Brown is my guest. She's a fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the 2009 book Shooting Up, Counterinsurgency and the War on Drugs. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. And remember, you can go on the Think page of kera.org and interact during the show itself with other listeners. Just click on the show link and tell us what you think about the program. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's certificate program in financial planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Vonda Felbaugh Brown. She is a fellow of the Brookings Institution in the Latin America Initiative and also the 21st Century Defense Initiative. She's in town to speak this evening to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. You can find information about that appearance at dallasinstitute.org. To join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Gabriel in Plano. Hi, Gabriel.
Hi, Chris. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a very good program. I have a comment and I have a question afterwards. Listen, I'm Mexican. I came to the United States a few years ago. And, well, one of the things that I can see is that in my culture, I think it's a cultural problem here, and it's very deep. My perception is that President Calderon is approaching in the wrong way to the problem. That's what is having very hard time finding a solution for this problem. I think he's attacking not the root of the problem, but something else. That's what is not being very successful at it. My perception, listen, when I came over here, I learned that Americans fight the discrimination. Culturally, Americans fight the discrimination. In my culture, it's natural to discriminate for the color of the skin, for the age, for the sex, for origin, north, south, everything. So there is a big problem because that divides the country, divides everything. So some people is more than other people, and some people is less than other people.
I think we've got that, Gabriel. Do you want to jump to your question now so we can make sure we get an answer for you?
Sure. My question is, what do you think is the biggest problem in that culture, in Mexican culture? Because my perception is that probably it's a cultural issue instead or I don't know. And what would be a possible solution for this? Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I have been actually very fortunate in my interaction with Mexican people of sort of all aspects of society, both very poor people operating in some of the areas of illegal cultivation of marijuana and pop in Mexico, as well as people who are very privileged and lived very comfortable lives in Mexico City, in really having very positive interaction. And I think one of the strongest thing that Mexico has going for itself is this extraordinary human capital, very warm people, very welcoming people. But as Gabriel was indicated, it's nonetheless a society that is also, like many parts of Latin America, very much separated, stratified by social classes, by the gap between the rich and the poor. And ultimately, I think what needs to happen is deep forms of integration that also bridge the stratification that is taking place. It requires both interaction. It requires that people are not behind the closed doors fearing violence, but it also requires a systematic policy from the government to address that, to reduce the people who are marginalized, politically marginalized, socially marginalized, to reduce the numbers of the people and to increase their ability to rise. And, you know, we are seeing some interesting changes. For a long time, the way to escape, to achieve social mobility, to escape grinding poverty and grinding discrimination and backward life was to either work in some illegal enterprise, such as a drug trafficking group, or to escape to the United States. But now we are seeing better economic opportunities in Mexico. We are seeing growth of the middle class in Mexico, as challenging, as difficult as it is. And so these policies need to continue, and there needs to be far greater reckoning about what it means to be Mexican, and understanding that and that everyone deserves access to public safety, that everyone deserves access to education opportunities and social mobility.
How does the availability or the lack of things like infrastructure and just public services play into this problem?
It does. And, you know, it would be sort of too simplistic to suggest that poverty or lack of access to public goods equals criminality. I mean, mm-hmm. there are some parts of the world that are very poor, parts of sub-Saharan Africa, and yet criminality is not necessarily very strong, very prevalent. Often you can have very low levels of criminality. But it is especially bad where criminal markets emerge with organized violent organizations in the context of very poor access to public goods mm-hmm. and very poor distribution of public goods. And it's especially bad for several reasons, one of which is that not only does the society become fractured and unable to respond in the way that we were talking about in Ciudad Juarez, Tijuana, where people takes them, you know, 3 hours one way to take their kids to school, 3 hours to get them back. If they then work 10 hours, what kind of time do they have to interact with their neighbors? So that's one component of it. But the other component is that if social goods, public goods, are not distributed among the population, then the drug trafficking groups themselves can develop what I call in the book political capital. Namely, they are seen as benefactors of the community. They come in with the money and put the money to a stadium, a school, perhaps a church. They might hand out money for a fiesta. They might bring in clinics. Sometimes drug trafficking groups or even insurgent groups become providers of public goods that the state fails to provide.
And then what happens is people are angry at the state for trying
to stop the narcos. Absolutely, and they stop being as angry as they should be mm-hmm. at the violent groups, at the criminal groups. And you have not only a society that is separated from the state, but society that is now pulled closer to the non-state entities, very problematic non-state entities. Mm-hmm. And so both to enable the community's response and to realign society close to the state and away from the problematic criminal groups, addressing public goods deficiency, including schools, healthcare, education, is critical.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next, let's speak to Oscar in Fort Worth. Hey, Oscar.
Hi, how you doing, Chris?
Very well.
I listen to your show often, and you actually interviewed one of my good friends last week, Dominic.
Oh, he was terrific, yeah.
Yeah, anyways, so I grew up on the border in Presidio, Texas, which is a really small border town, and I got to see, like, I grew up on both sides of the border, and I saw the great things that Mexico had to offer. I saw the bad things, and when I was younger, the violence wasn't as bad, but I remember knowing that sometimes the citizens themselves would take advantage of the corruption, as far as, like, I mean, even my parents, like, you get a ticket, instead of having to deal with it, you just give the police officer some money, and you call it a day, you go home, and that's it. And also, like, I remember there was a big drug dealer at the time that was control of the area of the small town of Ojinaga, Chihuahua, that he would actually give money to the schools. And I know that it's not all the citizens' fault, but at some point, like, I've always felt like, you know, why don't they speak up and, like, not accept that money? Why don't, like, at some point the fault somehow falls on the citizens as well. And I don't know what the guest's opinion is about that.
Well, you know, I think you're right. And our conversation with Gabriel, as well as our previous conversation about public goods, why do they matter, political capital of illegal groups, precisely connects with your question. That not simply the state, but society is responsible for reacting to criminality, reacting to violent criminality. The question, however, is what are the conditions that enable people as a community to stand up, as you suggested? One is what kind of violence they will face. If a community becomes mobilized but it gets slaughtered by the drug trafficking group, then, of course, other communities will not stand up. And so making sure that community leaders are protected is an important aspect of that, and making sure that society is as much protected from violence. The other aspect is that society needs to understand that the goods, that essential goods, access to jobs, ability to work in a legal economy, access to public goods, can be provided through other mechanisms than simply criminality. If they believe that their only way to get livelihood or social mobility is by participating in criminality directly or by accepting the handouts from the narcos, that in the absence of the handouts, the school will not have anything, then society will simply not do it. And so, you know, here the role of the state is to provide the structure of incentives to allow communities to say, no, we will not tolerate criminality, we will not tolerate violence. But it goes to deeper issues of rule of law and why people obey laws. One reason why people obey laws is because they fear prosecution from law enforcement. They feel they will have to pay some sort of penalty, some sort of fine. The other aspect is that people believe that the laws ultimately serve them, that it's the laws of the people, for the people, by the people, mm-hmm. that they can emotionally, intellectually relate to the laws, that they believe that the laws are in their interest. And part of Mexico's long-term problem, of course, is that many people don't believe that the laws are in their interest. They believe that laws keep them in a place of discrimination, in a place of marginalization. And if they believe that everyone else is breaking the law, well, then, you know, the laws don't serve me and I won't get caught anyway. Why should I then obey?
Yeah, Oscar's small example of, you know, paying a small bribe to get out of a traffic ticket is such a great one, because it really speaks to the importance of if you let that slide, then it means you really don't respect the police officers and what they stand for, because you know that you can't necessarily trust them to protect you.
Absolutely. And so, you know, part of, you know, police reform is making sure that no forms of corruptions are tolerated, and instilling in police officers a sense that no law can be broken, that as long as the law needs to be obeyed. But the reverse of that is that you actually need to generate support among the community for the officers and respect for the officers.
And pay them a certain living wage?
Pay them a decent wage that they can live on, but also respect what they're doing. You know, mm-hmm. Have some support your cop kind of mentality. TV shows that praise cops. I was once told by a Mexican person once explained the relationship to a police, to beat police officer in this way. He said, look, if you are somewhat smart and you live in a difficult situation, you join drug trafficking groups. If you are really stupid, you'll become a member of the police department. Mm. Well, if this is the attitude that community has toward the police officer, why should the police officer risk his life, the life, in some cases, her life, and the life of his or her family? And so you need both things. You need police that is not violent, that is not corrupt, that is not abusive towards citizens, and that is motivated to help citizens. But you also need citizens to appreciate that. And changing these dynamics is very complex and often takes, you know, a decade under a generation of officer changing under the best circumstances.
This is may strike you as a funny question, but are there TV shows that have hero cops in Mexico in the same way that we always have somebody in this country that we're supposed to sort of look up to?
Well, you know, actually, that has become a mechanism that the government of Mexico was promoting. They mm-hmm. they had a TV show, a cop show, that was to absolutely sort of glorify this police department fighting the drug trafficking group. Unfortunately, the show became so unrealistic. The officers were so good; they were there was no corruption problem uh-huh. at all. That the show became totally incredible, and no mm-hmm. one took the show seriously. And then it was revealed that government money was behind the show, and that police officers, regular police officers, were used in the show, and the whole concept became discredited. Mm-hmm. You know, if the show were only more realistic, yeah. Then, you know, perhaps it could have had more of an impact. And as this show was running last year in Mexico, at the same time, there was a show about a drug trafficking group. And about a female drug trafficker. And that show was far more popular and far more credible. And it was really, really sad how the public information campaign on the comp show just fell apart because it was so unrealistic and there was just no recognition of the internal problems of the police.
The last thing I want to ask you about, Vanda, is the aid that the United States is providing right now to try and help Mexico with this problem. Where is it best spent?
Well, there are the four aspects of the U.S. policy, what the U.S. policy calls four pillars. One is assistance in tracking down the criminals. Mm-hmm. Part of it is focused on the capos, on the heads of the organization, but part of it is focused on other elements of interdiction.
We have about 30 seconds, by the way.
Okay.
Sorry.
So let me just back up that there is focus on making the border not simply secure, but also enabling trade. Mm-hmm. Helping with police and institutional reform, justice system in Mexico. And the third aspect is what's called Pillar 4, and it's focused on socioeconomic programs. It has received the least funding, but in my view is one of the most innovative and important policy within that package.
Vanda Felbaugh-Brown is a fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the 2009 book Shooting Up, Counterinsurgency and the War on Drugs. You can read her recent report on Mexico's drug and organized crime problems online at brookings.edu. And Vanda will be speaking this evening at the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. Learn about that appearance at dallasinstitute.org. Vanda, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.